Hello, everyone, and welcome to this edition of Next Witness, Please. We're a podcast that decodes legal jargon, breaks it down into understandable everyday terms for just regular folks. Our goal is to build understanding about the law and our legal systems. I'm retired Judge Tom Hodson, and I'm joined by my co-host, retired Judge Gail Williams Byers. And today, we're talking about role models. November is National Inspirational Role Model Month. So we decided we should give some credit to role models we've had in our lives, and especially in the law. Now, this was Judge Gail's idea, and I have to give her credit, because this was this is something I wouldn't do, but I sent her, half in jest, a list of all the months that November was. You know, it's Diabetes Month and everything. And she shot back to me that this was National Inspirational Role Model Month, and so we ought to do something on that. And I thought, okay, let's do it. She shot me a list of like seven role models she's got, six, I guess, with bios and everything. So she's into this. And, you know, this being the Monday before Thanksgiving, you know, it's nice to lighten up a little bit. So,
indeed,
all right,
Judge, indeed.
All right, Judge Gail, I don't know how we're going to do this. I've got four, you've got six. We'll go back and forth. Let's talk about number one on your list and give the background and why.
And so even before we talk about number one, let me tell the audience that
National Inspirational Role Models
is beat out only by National Banana Pudding Month. So just know that you get this one
That's November too.
Yeah, right. That's also November. Instead of me talking about my favorite banana pudding recipe. So consider yourself saved and lucky. It's okay. Infamous, but it's something.
It's one of those go-to.
It is. It's a go-to dish that doesn't get burned up.
Here comes Judge Gail with their banana pudding.
In November.
There you go.
And I bring it to like every gathering, no matter the month, but definitely in November, which is why I was like, hey, we should consider this, but perhaps more timely is the National Inspirational Role Model.
My wife's got a sweet potato dish and a baked bean dish that she takes everywhere. So I totally get it. Yeah.
Well,
I've got beans.
You got beans and banana puddings. We are the B&B group.
You got it. Go ahead with your number one. And you don't have these ranked in order, right?
I do not. They are not necessarily in order. I'm just going to start with, you know, just one in particular, and then I'll go through, you know, them as we go back and forth. And if we get through all six, that's fine. If not, then just know that I've got some. This list is not exhaustive as well. These are just some of the people who inspire me. I am really blessed to be inspired by a lot of folks, but these are some of them. And I'm going to start, given the fact that we are all struggling with a little bit of high anxiety in this time of voting, concerned and crossing our fingers about voting outcomes, no matter which way you're going, but especially given what I think is going to be the outsized role of women in this election cycle, I'm going to say that maybe number one on my list is a woman by the name of Emmeline Parkhurst. Emmeline Parkhurst is known as the mother of the women's suffragette movement, and she may not be as well known here in the UK because she fought for women's rights in the late 19th and 20th centuries, and she actually led the movement for women to gain the right to vote as a British activist. And even to this very day, she continues to inspire that forward progress as societies continue to evolve and ensuring that women are included as a part of and a member of those important and pivotal voices who help to shape societies for many years to come. And so I'm really inspired by Emmeline Pankhurst because I think, again, in this current cycle we're in, women are playing a very pronounced role. They're being relied upon quite heavily. They're being courted quite seriously by both political parties. And they're going to be looked to, I think, from one party or another, to actually perhaps even deliver a presidency. And but for that suffragette movement, but for granting women the right to vote, but for granting all women the right to vote, and not just some women, but all women, and particularly women of color, we would not be having this conversation. And we certainly would not be having the conversation about how women are able to mobilize and how they are able to make considerable gains in the public sphere, and how those gains can help to not only underpin, but transform entire society. So congratulations, Emmeline Pankhurst, for being a wonderful national inspirational role model this November.
Well, you know, we think of often, too often, I think, the suffragette movement as being one of those clean and pristine petticoat movements, but it was down and dirty at many places. And these women were tough.
That just tells you the fight of women. We can get in, we can get dirty with the best of them.
You know, and you just think of the major movements in this country, the suffragette movement and the movement for prohibition. Led by women, and the prohibition movement started right there in Ohio, where you are, and where I was, and it blossomed out to become a constitutional amendment.
But you are so right.
They didn't mess around.
You are so right. And Tom, when you think about it, I don't know that we can necessarily think of any major movement that did not involve women being an integral part of it. Think of the civil rights movement and Rosa Parks being face of it. You know, again, all of these really important markers throughout history involve the, you know, not just the peripheral, you know, and tangential involvement of women, but I mean, the face forward involved activist participation of women, not just making their voices heard, but as you said, getting down and dirty with it and getting their knuckles a little bloody, getting under their fingernails a little dirty and getting in the scuffle in order to make things happen. And so I think, you know, when we circle back to this during Women's History Month, it's going to be worth it to talk about, you know, all the good things that women have been doing. But I'm really encouraged and inspired by this because, again, what you just reminded me of is just how just about every major movement in society involves or includes the face of some woman.
As an organizer, as not just a follower, but as a leader and an organizer.
Absolutely. We get in the game. And I think if anything, women have taught us that democracy in particular is a contact sport, that you have got to tag into the game, and that when you do, great things can happen.
Well, I'm going to go with one of mine, and that is Clarence Darrow. Now, for our listeners who may not recognize the name of Clarence Darrow, he was born in a small town in Farmdale, Ohio, at the end of the 19th century, but he became one of the most famous lawyers in the country. He was a great, probably the greatest labor attorney in the country, representing all kinds of unions back when they were just forming, including the United Mine Workers and other unions. Later in his career, after and this is interesting. He was a labor attorney. He then got indicted twice for jury tampering and bribing jurors.
My goodness.
Found not guilty both times. Both times. It was, as he claimed, sort of management's way of spoiling him or soiling him in the labor movement. After he got acquitted for both of those, labor dropped him as an attorney, even though he was the primary labor attorney. But then he became the country's preeminent criminal defense attorney. He was always opposed to the death penalty. He took on many death penalty cases. He was the attorney who did the Scopes trial on evolution.
Scopes monkey trials.
The Scopes monkey trial in Tennessee. He was the defense attorney, played by Spencer Tracy in the movie Inherit the Wind. If you ever you're into old movies, take a look at that. He was played by Spencer Tracy. He represented Leopold and Loeb. He represented blacks in Chicago when no other white attorney would, in some major confrontations with the white power establishment in Chicago. He was known for his closing arguments. One of them went on for 17 hours. His closing
argument. My goodness.
Argument. Yeah.
That is patience.
And another one in one of his cases where he was representing a black doctor who was inappropriately charged with a crime in Chicago, his argument went on for 12 hours. But he was known for his oratory and his ability. You'd think 17 hours, 12 hours, inordinately long by today's standards when attention spans about 8 seconds. But he brought jurors to tears. He brought judges to tears with his oratory. It was so brilliant. So one of my inspirational role models as a young man who wanted to represent anybody who was an underdog was Clarence Darrow, probably the king of underdog representers.
That is amazing. Judge, how do you think Clarence Darrow would respond to this current environment with the threat of union busting coming from one side?
He would be incensed. We have talked in prior shows about election litigation. He would be at the top of the line, I'm telling you. He was a leading member of the ACLU, and so he would just be leading the charge, I am sure.
I think he'd probably sign up to do it pro bono because committed.
I'm sure he would. He represented a lot of death penalty cases because he was so opposed to the death penalty. And he was, if you recall, the Scopes monkey trial went back and forth with William Jennings Bryan and Clarence Darrow. They were on opposite sides. And Clarence Darrow was an agnostic, was not religious by nature. And William Jennings Bryan was a person who interpreted the Bible literally. And so Clarence Darrow spent 2 days cross-examining. He put William Jennings Bryan, his opposing attorney, on the stand, cross-examining him on theories of evolution and the Bible. It went on for 2 days. And finally, the judge had enough. All this was outside of the presence of the jury, and after 2 days struck all of it, and the jury never got to hear one single word of it.
2 days of testimony.
Yeah, yeah. But Clarence Darrow was undaunted. So he's one of my heroes.
He says, onward. I don't care if it's stricken from the record. We'll still move on. All right,
back to you, lady.
And again, back to his point of really being a staunch opponent of the death penalty, I liken that to death of the Union. So he would be just as staunch an opponent.
That's right. He would be incensed.
Oh my gosh, that is amazing. But you are right. A brilliant legal mind he was, an exceptionally impassioned attorney who clearly he was the definition of a zealous advocate.
He absolutely was.
And
I've gone on in court, but never for 17 hours, I'll tell you.
I don't know a jurist who would have allowed me to go on for 17 hours.
It was a different time, but it was effective, I guess, at the time.
That's how he earned his reputation. So no doubt it was effective, especially if you can bring jurors and judges to tears and they don't resist showing their emotions. I think now there's certainly more of an effort to resist showing that type of emotion, no matter how great an orator the attorneys are, that you just really try not to show it, or at least I'll let you know how I feel about that because I've been called for jury duty. So should I be selected as a juror, I'll see how compelling it is and whether or not I can show it with a poker face or if I let my guard down.
Well, back in his hometown as he was growing up in Ohio, he was known as the village infidel.
Really?
I love it.
Oh, my gosh.
He was a supporter of female suffrage and a woman's rights advocate. So it ties in with your selection. We've got a theme going here.
Miss Emmeline Parkhurst. Absolutely. Absolutely.
You're next.
And to keep this theme going of Clarence Darrow committing a good portion of his career to supporting and representing particularly African Americans, those who would often struggle with finding good representation by others, I would say that my next selection for an inspiring role model would be Mrs. Henrietta Lacks. Now, if you don't know Henrietta Lacks, you'd have to go back to 1951. Henrietta Lacks, at the age of 31, was diagnosed with cancer. And she actually went to Johns Hopkins Hospital in Baltimore, Maryland, which at the time was one of the few hospitals in the country, and certainly one of the few in the areas that would even treat African Americans. And so this was actually one of the only places where she could go to get treatment, where she had learned that she was diagnosed with cancer. And I believe it was cervical cancer. At the time, while she was a patient at Johns Hopkins, and without her knowledge, her consent, without her family's knowledge or consent, she actually underwent a procedure at Johns Hopkins University Hospital where they removed and collected human cells from her that were determined to be immortal cells. And they were later dubbed or named HeLa, HeLa cells, because these were the cells that were determined to actually divide endlessly in a laboratory every 24 to 48 hours. And so this was actually the first discovery of a human cell line that could grow and divide endlessly in a laboratory, which allowed or led scientists to label these cells immortal. And as a result of this, these cells were then provided as biomedical research to research companies, institutions, and to colleges all over the world, which led to medical discoveries and breakthroughs that have now numbered into the thousands, including important vaccines like the polio vaccine, HPV vaccines, advancement in AIDS treatments and cancer treatments and Parkinson's. If you can believe it, Judge, these same HeLa cells that have been growing and continuing to endlessly grow for the last 7+ decades are still in use today. And these same HeLa cells were used to help create the COVID-19 vaccine.
And HeLa standing for Henrietta H-E-L-A Lacks, yep. Right?
Henrietta Lacks. Now, the amazing thing is, despite all of these medical breakthroughs and these research and the research that was done, the family of Miss Lacks was never compensated for the use of her cells. Although the biomedical research companies and the Johns Hopkins University, who, by the way, sold her cells to other research institutions, other hospitals, other pharmaceutical companies, they made money hand over fist. And it has been many, many years. And even the family has now sought to sue Johns Hopkins University for some portion of the billions of dollars the medical industry has made off of the division, I won't say the mutation, but the division of Henrietta Lacks cells that has literally been the key to unlocking these research discoveries that have helped to address, cure, and treat scores of diseases and infirmities and viruses that we would otherwise be facing, you know, just death and annihilation from. This woman has provided, and this is a Black woman who provided all of this. And I believe the world owes Henrietta Lacks a debt of gratitude. And in fact, Oprah Winfrey was the executive producer of the movie called The Immortal Life of Henrietta Lacks that actually outlined this journey of Henrietta Lacks from the time that she went to Johns Hopkins. She sought treatment. She wasn't treated very well as a Black woman, but again, with it being one of the few medical facilities that would even treat Blacks, it was one of the few options that she had. And as a result of that, Johns Hopkins, which boasts a considerable endowment, by the way, and biomedical research companies are able to make quite a bit of money from their research and the drugs that they produce. And they are producing this from the cells that were produced from Miss Henrietta Lacks, which, by the way, like I said, that was 70 years ago. And these same cells are still in use today to this very day.
Let me ask, was there any pushback, this being 1951, was there any pushback about using a Black woman's cells to cure Caucasians?
Absolutely. In fact, it's funny you said that, Judge, because initially Johns Hopkins sought to not disclose the original derivation of the cells and renamed them something different, placed a different label on the cells. And it was because the family began to do more research. And I forget how they came to know this, but they discovered that these were actually HeLa cells. They had originally been named, they were originally named HeLa cells. And then, as you said, there were certainly non-Blacks who were very against the use and introduction of a Black woman's anything, cells or anything else being used to treat them. So
same thing with blood transfusions. You know,
exactly. But obviously the medical industry knew the benefit of being able to have a human cell line that could grow and divide endlessly, which gave them, again, the ability to constantly test and to make breakthroughs and to create drugs and treatments. And so they purposely did not disclose the derivation of it and then sought to rename it only for it to ultimately be discovered that these were the HeLa cells or the cells from Henrietta Lacks that have been used now for over 70 years.
Wow.
Isn't that amazing?
That is amazing. And I have to admit, I did not know of her till I read what you sent me. What an incredible woman.
Absolutely incredible woman. She was married with children. When she developed cancer, she had just had her youngest child was still very small. I want to say maybe about a year or 2 years old. So when she passed away, which wasn't long after she was diagnosed because very few treatments were available fewer would have been available to Black women. So she succumbed to her cancer diagnosis very quickly, leaving behind a widowed husband and small children. And yet she became immortal because of her cells that continued to grow and divide and unlock so many medical mysteries for us.
Amazing story. Well, while we're
they should have gotten Clarence Darrow to represent the family.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. They should have. As we're talking about women as inspirational role models, let me tell you one of mine, and that is Justice Sandra Day O'Connor. She was an exceptional human being. She was an exceptional lawyer. She had an exceptional story. Most people will recall, I hope, that Justice O'Connor was the first woman ever nominated to the Supreme Court of the United States and the first woman ever to serve on that court. She served on the court for 24 years. Authored 645 majority, concurring, and dissenting opinions. That's an incredible number.
That's a lot of work.
My problem is not with Justice O'Connor, but the way people perceive her. She was a very tall woman, very stately woman. Came from a rural background in Arizona, lived on a ranch, decided to go to law school, went to Stanford Law School, graduated third in her class. In fact, graduated ahead of one of her classmates, who ended up being Chief Justice William Rehnquist. She graduated ahead of him in her class. They actually dated in law school, and then ended up being on the Supreme Court together. He is Chief Justice, and she is an Associate Justice. But one of the things I liked about her is that when she graduated from law school, nobody would hire a woman. Nobody would hire a woman lawyer. Now women are predominant in law schools. When I went to law school decades ago, I only had a handful of women in my law school class. So when she got out, she was the oddity and couldn't get hired. So she went to work in an unpaid position in a county attorney's office in California just to get her legal chops.
Really?
She went back to Arizona, became somewhat political, got a job as an assistant attorney general in Arizona, then ran for the Arizona legislature, then became, and this is where I really, my heart mends with her, is that she became a Maricopa County Superior Court judge. When I was at the court serving my judicial fellowship there, she was the only justice on the court who had been a state trial judge. And she brought that perspective to the court. She then moved on to the Arizona Court of Appeals, and in 1981 was nominated by Ronald Reagan to take a position on the court. And given all the controversy about today's Supreme Court and all of the trouble that we see with Supreme Court confirmation hearings, she passed the Senate 99-0.
What?
99-0.
Oh, yeah. Wow.
After, another thing that I admire about her is after she left the court, after she retired, she didn't sit just on her fanny and do nothing. She took assignments and sat in trial courts and in appellate courts around the country as a retired Supreme Court justice. You know,
wow.
So she's kept active with that. But the other thing I admire is that she led a major movement to protect government classes and civic education in public schools.
That is correct. I saw her out there
all over the country to do that, and was quite effective, at least in her time, of getting people to pay attention to that. So people will remember her as the first woman justice, but I'm telling you, her legal scholarship was first rate. She was a woman of character. Everybody on the court loved her. Liberals, conservatives, everybody loved her. She was quite active. She, the court, if people go through a tour of the court, they never see this, but when you work there, at the very top level of the court, way up, the very top level, there's a gymnasium. And there's a basketball court and a volleyball court and a gym. She was instrumental in getting that put in because she would work out with court staff almost every single day, clear up until her retirement time. Yeah, she was quite a woman of energy, a woman of scholarship, and a woman of integrity. So she's one of my legal heroes.
And for good reason. I remember seeing her making very, very public pitches for the benefits of civic education in public schools and ensuring that young people were taught the importance of knowing how their government works. She was a staunch advocate of that. And quite frankly, I think, you know, she would probably be a little disappointed and where we are now, where I think some teachers would say that they spend a lot of time kind of teaching to tests as opposed to helping to prepare students for their real life experiences, such as their civic responsibilities in society. And
knowing the three branches of government.
Yeah.
Basically how they work. You know.
Bring back Schoolhouse Rocky. Is what I say is, you know, it is, it's just that basic. But the fact that, you know, there was a time when we could rely on public school education to help ensure that our young people were prepared in this regard. And now to live at a time when there may very well be the threat to public education and there may be potentially no United States Department of Education. And therefore, the standards for teaching these things may go to the wayside because there's, you know, sometimes more of a focus on book banning than there is on, you know, your civic duties and responsibilities and knowing, as you said, how the three branches of government actually work and where, as a citizen, where you fit into that matrix, right? What role you can play. I had a young man yesterday, you know, ask me, you know, what can he do to become more active or to ensure that his voice as a citizen is being heard when it doesn't seem to perfectly align with the voices or the opinions of the major political parties. It's something that he's really impassioned about, and he's not sure how to cut through the noise, if you will, and how to, you know, make sure that these things are actually addressed. Well, I think civics classes in school kind of give you those tools. And these are the things that Justice O'Connor wanted to make sure that every child, not just the kids that had access to private school education or parochial education, but every child in every school and every corner of the country, whether it was a big city, urban area, rural community, hamlet, whether you were on Main Street or you were on living on any town in any town USA, that every kid had access to these basic tools, because America belongs to everyone, not just some of the ones. And if only we could return to a time when we embrace those same tenets that she was still, you know, fighting so hard to ensure. This is really just kind of that embodiment of embracing a cause greater than yourself, right? Because she had already served her time. Right. She had already done her public service. She was finished on the bench. She didn't owe anybody anything. But for her, this was a cause greater than her, because it helped to ensure that the next generations, plural, would be prepared to take the torch and continue to lead the country forward. And and like you, as an aside, I think it's pretty comedic that she leaves the Supreme Court and goes back and sits on a state court. Like, she's like, hey, look, I still got some gas in the tank. If you guys got a traffic case you need me to hear, or if you got an appeals case, you know, I'm ready for it. So just call me and I'll be there. That's funny.
She's also a model. You talked about civic education, but she's also a model of what Supreme Court justices ought to be. And we've talked about how the court has changed and become partisan. She was Republican.
Or ethically challenged, or morally bankrupt to some degree.
She was a Republican. She was conservative. She was not partisan. She led some of the major decisions in favor of affirmative action. You know, this was a woman who looked at things from a judicial point of view and not through a partisan lens. And
used the right lens.
Great credit for that.
Indeed. And wasn't afraid to just call it what it was, right? Even if it didn't perfectly align with someone else's political perspective, she was clear to hold true to her values that the court is not beholden to, you know, political influence, or it should not be beholden to political influence. Very different from what we perceive the court to be today.
All right, your turn.
And so, in keeping with, you know, great giants and you know, some of these other branches of government, I would say that my next inspirational role model would be President Lyndon B. Johnson.
And
particularly because of what it took for President Johnson to get the Civil Rights Act of 1964 over the finish line. I realize that people have differing opinions and views about President Johnson and his tenure in the White House, but I want to focus my inspiration, or the inspiration I draw from him, over, again, the hard work. It was no small feat to get the 1964 Civil Rights Act passed and signed.
Remembering, and the Voting Rights Act.
And the Voting Rights Act. Remember, this had been the groundwork that had been laid by President John F. Kennedy prior to his assassination. Quite a bit of work and lobbying had gone into this from you know, the NAACP and, you know, and SCLC and SNCC, but President Kennedy had been assassinated, and that left the work unfinished. it would have been extremely easy, especially given the divisions in the country. It would have been extremely easy for President Johnson to take the baton from now assassinated and deceased President Kennedy and completely abandon any effort to advance civil rights, because and under the auspices and the guise that the country wasn't ready. After all, you had Southerners in Congress that were preparing and had tried to filibuster the bill. And I mean, they talked ad nauseum. And President Johnson instead used the leverage of his power. He used the bully pulpit of the presidency to move the entire country forward on this important issue. I see this as an extremely courageous move when I think about the fact that, and I juxtapose that against some of the rhetoric we hear today, and I listen to a Donald Trump who says that, you know, President Lincoln was one of the greatest presidents of our times, but he should have struck a deal, right? And not really appreciating or understanding that when you're talking about President Abraham Lincoln and any deal that could be struck, at the time, the issue was whether or not the country would engage in a civil war, and that civil war would be about exclusively and based upon the issue of slavery and whether or not slavery would continue in the United States, and how in 2024 you can have a president that says Abraham Lincoln should have struck a deal, which, by the way, Judge, I don't know what deal that could be. I mean, are you suggesting that, you know, maybe the Southerners kept the slaves and that the Northerners didn't? I don't know what deal can be had when you're talking about trading human beings as if they are pieces of furniture and continuing to treat them like chattel, and how it took courage for Abraham Lincoln even then to do what he did and to face a civil war in this country, just like it took the courage of Lyndon B. Johnson to not walk away from the hard work that John F. Kennedy did in working with Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., the NAACP, and laying the groundwork for, as you said, not just the Civil Rights Act, but the Voting Rights Act, which has since been dismantled by the Supreme Court and has essentially been gutted. But the fact that these two were paired and that they were passed and signed by President Johnson is truly inspirational. And I hope that we can actually return to a time when we, again, that these ideals, these tenets that were born out of these acts are things that we can continue to embrace as a country. We didn't get it wrong when the Civil Rights Act was passed. We didn't get it wrong with the Voting Rights Act. And as you said just recently about Justice O'Connor, you know, even being a Republican, she didn't get it wrong in her support for affirmative action. But what we have seen, I think, as of late is kind of this effort to turn the clock back and to treat these things as if they either didn't happen or they weren't necessary. And they were. We wouldn't have needed a Civil Rights Act or a Voting Rights Act if we didn't have slavery, if we didn't have, you know, the courage of an Abraham Lincoln that says, hey, we shouldn't continue slavery in the United States. And by the way, we ought to, yes, treat Blacks. We should treat African Americans equally and fairly. And we should do everything we can to dispel and do away with Jim Crow and any remnants thereof. And I think it takes a lot of courage to do that. And especially, again, when you had President Johnson that was coming into office on the heels of his predecessor being murdered. I mean, clearly, surely this man could have feared for his life as well. It was obvious that, you know, there was enough animus and hate for President Kennedy, even though there are clearly folks who loved him. It only takes one person to hate you enough to kill you. And President Johnson, no doubt, could have felt the same way. And that could have been enough to stop him from wanting to advance these important tenets for Black folks. And he didn't. And I think that that's worthy of acknowledgement.
All right. I'll give you him as an inspirational role model during his first term, 1964 to 68. after that, all bets are off. Because then then we get into Vietnam and so forth.
I don't disagree. I'm only focused on those really 64 those two things.
64 to 68, and those things were amazing that he could pull it off with every technique that he could. If anybody is interested, you need to go to the Johnson Library at the University of Texas at Austin and listen to some of the tapes of him strong-arming senators and House members to get those two things passed. It's really
isn't it crazy to be able to be the fly on the wall and to hear, you know, what had to happen to get it over the finish line. And quite frankly, here's the thing, Judge, here's what we know. Oftentimes, this is how the sausage is made. Right?
Yeah. It sure is. Hey, I want to move on, and I want to give you one more here because I want to talk about him too. And that's Justice Thurgood Marshall. But I'll let you take the lead.
Yes, I'll let you go first.
Well, he really had a distinguished career. If anybody doesn't know, he was first African American appointed to the Supreme Court. But he also was the attorney for the NAACP, argued so many major cases before the court, Brown versus Board of Education, first African-American, as I said, appointed to the court, served on the court for decades. And as Justice O'Connor was on the court, Justice Marshall was on the court when I was there.
Lucky you,
as a judicial fellow. But that time it was towards the end of his career, and he was just grumpy. He just grumped around at everybody. But a couple of things I think were interesting about him. If I could just share a couple of stories before I turn it back over to you, he hated the word black and hated the word African-American. He wanted to be referred to as Negro.
Negro. Mm-hmm.
And he was so adamant about that, that the Supreme Court style book, whenever it was referred to as an African-American or black, it was stricken and Negro was put in its place. He demanded that the style book reflect his personal feelings about that. And the first time the word black was used was after he had passed.
Wow. Really?
Really. He had that much power on the court, and he felt that strongly about the terminology.
I don't know that I ever knew that. I do know... obviously, NAACP is the National Advancement for the Association of Colored People. Right. So I wondered how he felt about the phrase colored people, since he spent so many years as essentially the face of the NAACP in so many regards.
He said, I am a Negro. I am. That's my race. And that's what I want to be called. And that's everybody similarly situated. With me, that's what they deserve to be called. I thought that was a pretty strong statement, and the rest of the justices went whatever you want. He was really a power, and he was a big man. Yeah, he was a big man. Whenever he would laugh when he was on the bench during oral argument, and justices pass little notes back and forth. They're like little kids sometimes. And he would see something that was funny, but his whole body would just sort of go up and down like this big walrus. You know? There was no hiding that he found something humorous. I thought this was interesting too. When I was there, I don't know if it still exists, but when I was there, the Supreme Court had its own barbershop and the justices could go down and top staff people could go down, not me, but top staff people and justices could go down and get their hair cut when they had like their own barber. So he had a barber specifically that would cut his hair. But oftentimes you would see him coming out of the barbershop. And I finally inquired, why was he in there so often? He would just go out, go in there and hang out and sit in the chair and talk to the barbers. You know, it was his old community barbershop mm-hmm. that he had at the Supreme Court.
That's so funny.
It was his way of getting the real story from the real people.
And also probably staying connected, right?
Connected.
Because being on the bench can sometimes make you feel disconnected from
and
society.
All the barbers were black.
Yeah.
So he felt comfortable and he would go there and he would just talk and they would talk and it, you know.
And I'm willing to bet you that's where he felt comfortable code switching. He probably was able to go there and use a totally different vernacular, feel
I'm
a different
sure
level
did.
Of comfort, relate on a different level. With,
I'm sure he
you know,
did.
Different touch
it,
points to
it
to
was
folks
his there. It was his safe place.
Indeed,
the Supreme Court barbershop.
Yes.
And one last quick story. When I was there, he was almost blind. He couldn't see very well, and the court was trying to convert over to computer systems, and he hated doing stuff on computer. Just hated it.
Oh, goodness.
And his clerks would try to get him to do it. And every once in a while, you'd be walking down the hall and you'd see them taking into his chambers giant TV monitors so he could see.
What?
So he
couldn't
could
see him.
What was coming up on his computer.
Oh, my goodness.
And I think the record was one of them stayed in his office 2 days.
Oh, my goodness.
Because you'd walk down the hall a day or two later, and it'd be out in the hallway on some kind of stanchion ready
oh my
for
goodness.
Somebody to pick up.
Oh, my goodness.
He wasn't having it. He wasn't making that conversion.
Oh my! So, he's kicking and screaming. He is kicking and screaming.
All of those are the personal side of Justice Marshall. So
you know what? It is so good to hear that side of him because unlike you, I didn't have an opportunity to meet him or get to know him personally. And so I've had the chance to kind of revere him from afar and to know about his experiences as, again, the face of the NAACP, to learn about, you know, his strategy. One of the things that really you know, kind of endeared me to what I feel like is his brilliance was actually his brilliance in crafting the strategy in Brown versus Board, right? You would think that, you know, one incident should be enough. But what he was very clear to do is to make sure that he created a compelling argument for the Supreme Court that made it undeniable the treatment of blacks versus their white counterparts by tracking and keeping track of all of these experiences across the experiences of multiple black children or multiple Negro children in the South, as he would insist on saying. And that the compilation of this is what really helped to create and bolster the case that made it kind of undeniable for the Supreme Court, in a sense, to recognize it and also to have the track record that he had. Many people may not know, you know, Brown versus Board of Education is not the only case that he argued before the U.S. Supreme Court. He was very comfortable arguing before the United States Supreme Court and was equally successful with many of his cases that he argued there. So returning there.
And at that time, nine white men.
Yeah. And so achieving any success in you know, in arguing cases before 9 white men as a black man, where in many instances, you know, much like, you know, how I know how I felt, especially when I was the first black woman elected to my seat in South Euclid, when, you know, it felt like, you know, the white people there saw me as a quote uppity Negro, and they probably still do. I could only imagine the perceptions that he was fighting against, the many times he went to that Supreme Court. And nonetheless, he walked away victorious many times. And so it kind of was poetic, if you will, that he would spend a good chapter of his career as a justice in the very court that he had argued before, because he was not a stranger to that environment. He knew what it took. He had risen to the occasion many times over, and he was a very thorough, methodical litigator. I mean, this man was, mind you, he was flanked with a really good team, Constance Baker Motley, Charles Hamilton Houston, and the like. So
you got to have that point person. And
he didn't do it alone, but he ran point on all of these, and he did a phenomenal job in bringing to light and actually putting a mirror in front of these 9 white men on the Supreme Court and showing them the country that we were all living in, and the difference between the country that whites were living in versus the country they had then relegated Negroes to live in, and the inherent unfairness in all of this. And so I think we owe him, you know, a debt of gratitude. It would seem that he would be an obvious inspirational role model given this month, but no matter how obvious it is, I think it goes without saying that certainly Justice Thurgood Marshall is an amazing inspiration. And it also should go without saying that despite, you know, his passing and his death and him leaving the court, that, you know, that his replacement on the Supreme Court is certainly no replacement for him. They are diametrically opposed. They do not have the same value system. And I just believe that we would all be better served by having someone who actually embraced the credo of Justice Marshall back on the bench, even more so as opposed to who's there now.
We're running out of time. We can't make it to all of our lists. Can I slip in one more quick one?
Anything for you, Judge. Come on, with one more.
Just real quick one, because we only have a couple of minutes left. And that is, this is not a lawyer. This was an inspirational role model when I was 5 years old, to probably up to being 10 or so. And that was Roy Rogers.
Really?
Roy Rogers, king of the Cowboys. He was born by the name of Leonard Sly in Cincinnati, Ohio, but moved not far from where I used to live in Portsmouth, Ohio, down on the Ohio River. And the reason that I find him as an inspirational role model is that through the hundreds of movies and television shows that he did, his shows stood for telling the truth, standing up for what's right, fighting for the underdog with all your might. He never killed anyone. He only shot the gun out of their hand or scared them with it. So he didn't commit any violent acts. He was personally honest, hardworking, and taught empathy and kindness. That was my role model as a young man. Maybe that's why I became a defense attorney, looking for the underdog, huh?
Maybe, but you know what, Judge? I just taught a course yesterday on judicial temperament, and a lot of what you said are the exact traits that we hope to see in judges who demonstrate great judicial temperament. patience, empathy, kindness, compassion, open-mindedness, thoughtfulness. These are all the things. And there's a good reason why. Not only were you a phenomenal defense attorney, but clearly an amazing, amazing jurist that we've had the benefit of having you as a public servant. So way to go, Roy Rogers, and way to go, Judge Tom.
My young inspiration. Mm-hmm. All right. Tell people how they can find us, please.
Oh, well, we are so excited to have you listen in and check us out, even when we're doing something a little more lighthearted. So please make sure you continue to follow us anywhere you would find your favorite podcast episodes. And we ask you to perhaps consider, first and foremost, our most preeminent partner, that being National Public Radio, or NPR, which has both a national and international appeal and outlet. You can also find us anywhere else you find your favorite podcast. So any platform you use to find your favorite podcast, you can just use that search tool and put in NWP or type Next Witness, Please, whether it be Apple, Spotify, Amazon, or anywhere else you find your favorite podcast. We'll be there waiting for you, because we know that you don't trust what you don't understand, and our goal is to increase your understanding so that you can ultimately trust us. We hope that you have enjoyed listening. And when you do listen, don't just like us. Make sure you subscribe, continue to follow us, because we'll be back again with more interesting conversations.
And if you have any topics you would like for us to cover in the future, just shoot me an email. You can do that at Hodson, H-O-D-S-O-N, Hodson at ohio.edu. That's Hodson at ohio.edu. Next Witness, Please is produced through the auspices of WOUB Public Media in Athens, Ohio. Colin Cameron is our co-producer and audio engineer. We'd like to thank you all for joining us and listening. Judge Gale and I will be back really soon to give you more insights into the law. Until then, have a good day, everyone.
Take care, folks.